Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We're going to get started with music in East Corinth, get a recap and analysis of what happened around the state on primary election day yesterday. We'll rev up the Rambler in anticipation of this weekend's antique car show, and then we'll immerse ourselves in Morrisville history. But first, let's head to the mountain to learn about Sunday's Music on the Mountain concert at Northeast Slopes in East Corinth. Joining me to talk about it is Boo Blodgett, who's organizing Sunday's Music on the Mountain. Boo, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Yeah, good morning, Rick, but actually it's Wade first, and I'm going to hand you right over to Boo.
Okay.
We're just getting you set up and introduced. And Boo's dad and my dad were friends in high school in the 40s and right up through, and had a lot to do here with Northeast Slopes and the attached communities. And I guess we're kind of trying to carry that along here. So, yeah, we've got a little music festival coming up on Sunday, noon to 6. We're calling it Northeast Slopes Music on the Mountain. And I'll hand you over here in a second to Boo, and he knows more of the musicians.
All right.
He's involved with the local music scene, where they do a lot of open mic and performances down here in Bradford and other venues, and has been for quite some time. So without further ado, here's Boo.
All right. Boo, how you doing?
Good morning, Rick.
Morning. Hey, Boo, give us an overview of Music on the Mountain.
Well, what we're trying to do, it's definitely an effort to provide funds for the area kids so that they can get an opportunity to slide and ride and interpret skiing on at Northeast Slopes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the type of thing where I started here 60 years ago, and I plan on finishing up here.
So. Wow. Well, Boo, is the name of the event a slight nod to Marshall Tucker Band's Fire on the Mountain?
Well, I don't know if I really even thought about
okay.
it. Just threw some catchy phrases out there, and I guess we agreed on this one.
It's a good one.
I guess it's no.
All right. Well, who gets the day started, Boo?
Well, actually, I'm going to get it started. I'm
yes.
a singer-songwriter and just played in bands in previous years way back and just enjoy music, and that's a lot of we're going to have quite a few singer-songwriters.
Yep, we'll get to that. You got a great all-day lineup going on at Music on the Mountain, and it starts at noon. You'll be playing at noon. What time can people start arriving there at Northeast Slopes?
Probably around 11:30 would be good. You know, we just want to have a little opportunity to get the food service in and get organized as far as being volunteers.
Now, you're going to be playing. Have you ever played at Northeast Slopes before? Is this something you do regularly? Or?
Well, I haven't played here, per se. As far as playing music, yeah, I play regularly,
yeah.
Weekly at open mics or just privately with friends and family.
And Boo, do you remember the first time you went up the tow rope and skied down Northeast Slopes?
Well, I'm afraid that's a little foggy. When I was 6 years old, but I remember wearing a few uniforms, just going up and down and snapping a big rope and just
yeah.
jumping jumps and just had a big grin on my face.
I love it. All right, let's shift back to Wade for a moment. I'm going to move you back and forth a little here. So, Wade, you back on with me yet?
I am. I'm on the other line.
Oh,
I
don't
have any
okay.
feedback here, but I think so.
All right, so you both can hear me at the same time now?
We can.
Okay, perfect. So, Wade, forgive me for not knowing the history, but is this a tradition to have a concert at Northeast Slopes during the summer months?
It hadn't been up until, I guess, around 2015 or so, and that's when we started the kids' middle school ski program up here, and we needed to raise some funds. We had some seed funds the first year, and they said this is going to be a sliding scale over the next few years, and so you guys got to get out and raise some money, and we'll keep supporting it until you guys are self-supportive, and we have been. We had Nest Fest in October every year, starting in 2015, and right up through till the good old COVID came through, and we had to take off a couple years.
Yeah, that really scuppered a lot of things. Well, the price is right. Tell us about what you're asking concert goers to pay, Wade.
Yeah, well, just park in the big parking lot, and we'll funnel you through a little entry area, and it's just going to be drop a donation in the bucket, whether it's you, your spouse or significant other, your family, whatever. Just come in and donate what you can. You can do it on the way in, you can do it on the way out, or halfway in between. And it's just, there's no particular suggested donation, just whatever you can do for us to help out the ski program and enjoy the music throughout the day. You know, some people, I'm sure, can come and go. It's noon till 6. And Waits River General Store will be doing the food again, and they'll have some special items on the menu. I know when we had our endurance event here, they put together some pulled pork and some cold pasta salads and stuff that were great, you know, as well as the hamburgers and hot dogs.
Yeah. And, Wade, tell us more about the youth ski program there at Northeast Slopes.
Well, we just, you know, we've always helped out anybody we could. Back with my dad's day and up through, we've, you know, always had informal lessons. Wednesdays was a big day because the school used to get out early, and then that changed, and we thought that was going to be the end of it. But if anything, I said, let's just take it by the reins and, you know, really, really bring it up to scale, you know, up a couple notches. And we knew that one of the hindering factors was not only the cost of tickets and lessons at other places, but equipment, too. So, you know, for an adolescent that's growing, you know, 2 foot sizes a year, probably, especially once they hit middle school, you know, buying new equipment was just crazy at $600 to $1,000 a set for kids. And so we use Slope Style. They've been very good. They've supported us from the beginning, and now there's other schools using them too. You know, on our example, I guess we were their first school, and that Slope Style ski and ride over to Montpelier, and the kids get fitted, you know, to boots, and then they fill out the forms, the height, weight, and ability, and we raise these monies to get these kids $99 ski leases for the season to use as they wish for the whole winter.
And how many kids take part annually in that program?
Most ever this last year. We had 75 kids in the program, and I think we had 69, you know, rented leases that we paid for.
Mm. Hey, Boo, why is this something that you were really excited to get involved with and set up for Northeast Slopes?
Well, I believe it's a very good cause for area children to be able to, like I say, slide and have some fun and ski with their friends. And it's also, I enjoy the music and the music scene, and we have some very good quality people coming out that are willing to donate their time. So we want to actually even provide entertainment and just a good Sunday afternoon event.
All right, so Boo, give us a kind of the picture of how things are going to be set up on Sunday. Where's the band? Where the band's going to be? Where's the crowd going to be?
Well, we have a stage here at Northeast, about a 32-foot stage. It faces the slopes, so we'll have people just scattered on the slope, a mowed slope, so they can listen. It's a type of amphitheater, so that it projects quite well. We're going to have a two-stage system because we have so many performers that we're going to have a performer sing and play for 20 minutes plus, and then we're going to switch and try to keep music going throughout the day.
And folks are just going to hike up the hill. You're not going to have your senior rope toeologist there, you know, working the rope toe that day, right?
No. It's a little too quick to try to ride the rope with no skis or something slippery on your feet.
All right. Boo, you lead the you get it all started, so that'll set the mountain afire. But tell us about some of the other bands coming on stage right after you.
Okay, what we have is a lot of individuals with some friends and family backing them up.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of singer-songwriters, original players. We have, like, one in the area that actually called Lenny Johnston, who plays with her sister, and they've been playing music for years. We have, like, Annie Stearns, a Northeast Kingdom singer-songwriter. kind of a Joni Mitchell type. We have Bill Carroll, Chris Martin, and Donna Thunder that each have their own band, but want to come and play together. So we have a backup guitar player and Phyllis Shea that's going to play cello in the background if people need it. We have a Brian Berwick, initially from L.A., that is a singer-songwriter from Haverhill. He says he's a little south of folk and north of blues.
I love that.
Thomas Chapin and Emily Marsh, a.k.a. the Fairlanes. They play original heartfelt music. We have Dwayne Benjamin, a singer-songwriter from Bradford that has a good old country sound. And here's a unique one. Brian Blanchett is an Abenaki singer-songwriter and a Berklee College of Music alumni who does a lot of Abenaki, and he calls it Abenglish language infusion music, so that should be interesting.
That should be.
We have Randy Wales, who's a local kind sort of John Prine influenced
like that
singer-songwriter. And then we're going to have those raffles, and we're going to finish up with a Highway 5 band, Lance Mills from Fairley, Dean McCarthy, and Gary. And Gary started working in Las Vegas, playing out there for years. So a lot of these people have a lot of background in music, but in the stage now in their life where they're not trying to run around the country playing. So
they're settled down here in Vermont, and they're going to be out at Northeast Slopes on Sunday. And it's kind of great. You've got 20-minute sets and then 5-minute changeover. And as you mentioned, Boo, you'll have two stages, so it'll be that changeover will be pretty quick. You know, for people, they won't be sitting around in between sets too long.
Correct. That's what we hope. Of course, we always hope it goes flawlessly, but you never can tell.
Yeah, every once in a while you get a little bit of feedback, something a wonky mic. But I went to a fundraiser for Ukraine. This was back in the spring at Arts Riot, and it was the first time I'd been to a show like this where there was 20-minute sets, and I thought, oh, man, how are they going to be able to move from one to the next? And it does move quickly. And it's a great way for the audience to stay engaged, be exposed to a lot of different artists. Is that what you hope people will take away from the concert on Sunday?
Yes, that they understand why we're doing it, but also that they get exposed to a variety of music. And we know the variety is the spice of life, so that's what we're trying to shed some light on here.
Well done. Wade, tell us again what will be available for people to eat and drink that day.
Well, like I said, Waitrover General Store has been doing our winter food for the last couple of years. They've been doing our events down here under the tent. And so, which we will have a tent. It looks like a beautiful day, but you need to get into the shade a little bit. We got three-quarters of the tent will be available off the side of the stage where you can still see the stage and obviously hear it.
Yeah.
But there'll be some, undercover seating there. But, yeah, they'll have, hamburgers, hot dogs. They had some pasta salads they made in-house, and I'm not sure what they're bringing. Maybe some pulled pork. Pulled pork sandwiches are good that get locally smoked and done here with their own sauces on them and stuff. And they'll have some surprises just like they do during the winter, usually a crock pot or two or something going. And very reasonably priced and easy access right here beside the stage. And you can go sit back on your blanket in your lawn chair and have it. We're not having a beer garden, so bring your own beverages. Whatever you do bring. Lemonade, soda, water, whatever you want. We are not prohibiting alcohol, but we want to keep it within reason on the grounds, of course. But it's carry in, carry out, And, yeah, that's what's going on for food out here in front of the stage. Within the half hour, we have a bouncy house that's being donated by Real Bounce over there, Rick Chiquette, up to Jet Service Envelope. And he always supplies us with a small bouncy house, something for the kids to rattle around in. And I don't know, what else do we get something else coming, Boo? Did you get anything else arranged?
That's negative.
Negative, okay. Well, this is a totally different event. We always try to put on a really big event and something for everybody here in Pig Roast and Beer Tent. And I think it's refreshing to step back and do something very simple in nature like this. And I'd like to plug in one, all these musicians he listed off, and I believe we have filled all the slots, but my neighbor off my back deck, and there's just a river between us, he comes here from L.A., and he is an internationally known violinist and has multiple recordings out in the world, and he can play just about anything, and he's excited because he's usually gone by October and back to L.A. and performing and touring, but he's here, and he's going to come here Sunday. I just caught up with him yesterday, and he told me one time that there was out in, you know, West Texas somewhere, some country western, you know, concert or something, and somebody talked him up getting on the stage, and here, that is not his genre whatsoever. And he said, well, just fall in behind us and try to keep up. And whoever the band leader was, it was a pretty prominent band, too, he turned around and he says, David, you play a pretty good fiddle. But that was pretty good. And that's what he's going to do. He's going to come in and listen a little bit, and he might jump in with somebody. Him and Phyllis, you know, between that violin and cello.
Yeah.
You know, backing up Dwayne or somebody. It's a very eclectic collection.
Oh, that's beautiful. You know, Wayne, I know you're multi-talented, but you're not going to surprise me and tell me that you're playing in one of these bands on Sunday, right?
I'm a shower singer, and for good thing. Even my cat won't stay in, so we're gonna stay out of that. I can play a radio pretty good.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. All right. Now, Boo, in addition to all the music and the food and what you had mentioned that there will be raffles, door prizes. Tell us about those.
Well, I think Wade understands that a little bit.
Oh, okay.
I'll give it, but I'd like to just do a shout out to a few individuals and people here too that we thank the NAS board for even allowing this to happen, and the Waits River Store for providing food.
Yeah.
Matthew Strong at East Coast Van Builds in Bradford's going to provide the audio, and all the performers for the time and the audience for their support. I just want to wish a big shout out and thank you.
Yeah, that's great, Boo. Wade, tell us about those raffles, door prizes.
Yeah, so we're just going to throw together a potpourri of donated items, and a lot of them are actually coming from Northeast. We'll have some pairs of day tickets, maybe a set of 4-day tickets. I believe we'll put together a single season's pass, which is if you win it, you for an extra $100, you're able to upgrade it to a family pass, which is usually $345, and a single pass is $140, give or take. And so that'll be in there too. But the first prize on raffles, the grand prize. One of our board members, whose father again worked with my father here, you know, on this place for years, and he grew up skiing here, and now he's on our board and is a young adult. He has built a custom set of Northeast Sloped insignia cornhole board set.
Wow.
And they are really nice. They're all signed by board members, and, you know, up underneath on the backside, and they're painted, and they got our Mariner's Compass Northeast Slopes trademark on them. And, and they're going to be out for not only display, but they're going to be out for people to play on until the raffle comes. And we're probably going to be raffling somewhere between 4 and 5 o'clock, 4:30-ish. Got to be here to win, so, you know, buy your tickets and, you know, maybe jot your name on them, hand them to a neighbor or something. Maybe they'll give you the prize when they get done. Maybe they'll keep it. I don't know.
But, that's right.
Yeah, we'll be turning around up until, you know, 4:30, quarter of 5, and then pulling the raffle tickets. And there'll be door prizes off the non-winners, and we'll just work our way down from there. Just be one sale of tickets.
All right. And Wade,
maybe some maple syrup. I think Lim Laws, we got some maple syrup here. So might be a gallon of maple syrup to walk away with.
Yeah. We got about a minute left, Wade. I know this is the second event over the last couple of weeks at Northeast Slopes. How'd those runners do who were up there a couple of weeks ago?
Well, a lot of them were eliminated pretty quickly. you know, this little hill really, really was underestimated by a lot of very, very good accomplished runners. And it came down to, and I wish I had her name in front of me, but I don't. She wanted to kind of stay anonymous, but she was from New Jersey, and she clipped off 11 and half plus minute laps
all day long. And a friend of ours, who actually his father is the head of Highway 5, will be closing out the show here, and I listened to last night in Fairley. He kept up with her for 8 hours and 20 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he did. He ended up doing 24 plus one, which is the minimum to get a medal in recognition. 24 one-mile laps up and down around the mountain through the woods and back down the beginner slope, and he was a hurting puppy by the end of the day. But kudos to him for getting second place and staying in there. But if they had come in teams against this gal, that I don't think anybody would have.
Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. All right. Music on the Mountain takes place this Sunday from noon until 6 at Northeast Slopes in East Corinth. Admission is by donation, and the event benefits the Northeast Slopes Youth Ski Program. You can learn more by visiting northeastslopes.org. Boo, Wade, thanks for organizing this. Thanks for letting us know about it.
And thank you to Boo, because he stepped in with this expertise that I don't have for this local talent and the idea behind this event. I kind of call it a pop-a-ray or almost like a poetry slam. It's a music slam with these 20-minute events.
And yeah.
I think it's going to be enjoyable for everybody, and you don't know what you're going to get till you get here.
But, all right. Well
thank
done.
You, thank you, Boo. He's on the other line.
All right. We're going to take a break, and then we'll parse the numbers from yesterday's primary elections. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group, we're more than just radio.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. Primary elections tend to be rather mundane affairs, especially when you have a litany of politicians running for re-election. But then Senator Patrick Leahy decided to spice things up by deciding to retire. And the coronavirus pandemic made serving in statewide offices and at the State House a bit more challenging than usual. So there really was a reason to choose one of three primary ballots and fill in those little ovals this year. Joining me now to run through the results from yesterday is Middlebury College political science professor Matt Dickinson. Matt, great to have you back on Vermont Viewpoint.
It's good to be with you, Rick.
And listeners, if you'd like to ask Matt about the results or if you have an observation of your own from yesterday, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255, or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Matt, before we dive into the numbers, how late do you stay up on election nights? When do you know it's time to kind of turn the lights out?
I will, without going into details, it was a late night, or yeah, perhaps more accurately, a very, very early morning. It's just the nature of the beast. These things don't come around very often, and there's always postmortems trying to figure out,
yeah,
as the final data is coming in, exactly what we saw here.
Yeah, I wait till at least about 95% of the state is in, and even I leave my computer on. Last night, you know, anytime I'd wake up, I'd go back out to the computer to see if there's a little bit more info, if anything changed. I kind of enjoy it that much. So how was turnout yesterday?
Turnout was high. I am trying to access the latest results on the Vermont website. Thanks to our wonderful high-speed internet in Vermont, it's not coming in yet.
Of course.
But as of last check, so the comparable data that I was looking at was 2018, last time we had a midterm primary, and turnout there was about 22% of registered voters, about 107,000. When I finally called it a night, we were over 120,000 votes last night, and that was with a lot of Burlington still not in. So I don't have the final numbers, but I think turnout, as expected, was quite high. And the reason, of course, is we had some high-profile competitive races for the first time in a generation.
And much heavier on the Democratic side than on the Republican side.
Yeah, roughly 3-1,
yeah,
on the Democratic versus Republican turnout. And I think that was partly a function of we have a blue state here, and we can talk more about how blue it's become. But also, most of the high-profile competitive races were on the Democratic side.
They were. Let's look at some of the biggest surprises that you saw yesterday. We'll start on the Republican side. Anything that kind of shocked you?
Well, Christina Nolan spit the bit here.
Yeah.
She was a high-profile candidate, raised a lot of money running now for the Republican Senate nomination. On paper, she seemed to have everything you would want in a candidate. But my sense is she was just outworked. And it's got to be a disappointment to the Republican Party leadership, because in talking to other candidates and their staff for Myers Murmel and Gerald Malloy, there was a concerted effort to clear the field for her. They didn't follow the orders, and Malloy ended up winning a fairly comfortable margin by almost 5% over Nolan. So that surprised me. There are, you know, all sorts of reasons why this happened, but there is a sense that she was outworked.
Big names came out in support of her, came into the state to help her raise money. So this had to be really shocking to Republicans. How about on the Democratic side? Anything that surprised you?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a surprise, but Becca Ballen's victory was by a bigger margin than I anticipated. I think there was a sense she had the momentum. We can talk about the role of outside spending here. She was clearly flooding the airwaves. I could not open my mailbox without getting hit in the head with a Ballen flyer.
Right.
So I am not surprised she won, but at last check, it was over a 20% margin. I did not expect that.
Well, we did have some inkling that there was something afoot with that UNH, University of New Hampshire poll that came out a few weeks ago that showed her at that point ahead 63-21%. She wound up with about that number in the final tally, but Molly Gray did come closer than the poll showed. But even still, you know, I didn't get the sense up till that point that there was such a groundswell in support of Becca Ballen. Were you, you know, surprised when those numbers came out and saw her that far ahead?
Well, I was. And to be clear, you don't have to be Lewis Myers to question that particular poll, the methodology. And, you know, it did nail Becca Ballen's figures, but they had a 40% margin here, and it was not 40%, so we
right.
should be clear, it was about half that.
That's
so
right.
It wasn't the most accurate poll, but it was an inkling that this race wasn't as close as a lot of us thought it was until that poll came out.
But that poll also did show that Malloy was ahead of Christina Nolan and wound up, you know, being pretty similar to the final results. Now, one that they got wrong is in the GOP House race. Erica Reddick was ahead in that poll, just slightly, but I would think this was another surprise. Liam Madden winning. This is a candidate who, you know, is an independent, pretty much flipped a coin to decide which primary to run in. You know, said he wanted to run in both primaries, had to pick one, so he picked Republican. And winds up beating Erica Reddick and Anya Tino, making her third attempt to become a representative of Vermont. How surprised were you by Liam Madden's victory?
Well, somewhat surprised. I didn't have a good feel for this race, but he was a candidate who openly, as you observed, admitted that he was using the Republican primary as a vehicle. Because he thought it had gave him the best chance to get into the general election, but that he wasn't a Republican. You might remember in one of the debates when asked about the politicians he most admired, I forget the specific context, but he mentioned Bernie Sanders and Ron DeSantis.
Right.
I mean, how can you explain that? He shows up to a debate in bare feet and shorts, and yet he wins, and again, rather decisively. Now, both Reddick and Tino, I think, split the Republican vote here. Madam only got 41% of the vote, but still, this, I think, is an indicator of just how weak the Republican bench here is.
Yeah. I know this isn't a big deal, but I want to kind of look at Governor Scott's performance yesterday. Now, there wasn't much drama in the gubernatorial races, granted. But, you know, he only took 68% of the in the GOP primary against two kind of newcomers to state politics. I think he fared better in the general election 2 years ago against David Zuckerman. Was it just a matter of, you know, supporters not showing up just because they knew he had a walk in the primary?
Well, I guess that would be part of the explanation, but let's be clear here. He is an individual who polls consistently now as having stronger support among Democrats than among Republicans in the state of Vermont. There is a sense among more traditional Republicans and those who adhere to the Trump wing of the party that Phil Scott has strayed in areas like gun control and on other issues from Republican Party orthodoxy.
And did get a number of write-in votes on the Democratic primary side against Brenda Siegel.
Yeah. My wife, who's a town clerk, noted that in our particular town, a lot of Democrats writing in Phil Scott.
Yeah. Anything, you know, you can take away from the various results on the GOP side? It looks like Malloy would definitely appeal to the more Trump wing. You have, you know, the moderate wing that would support Phil Scott. Winner in the lieutenant governor race was Joe Benning, although probably not as big a victory as I thought it might have been. But, you know, there was some, you know, that were more moderate Republicans, some that come from the Trump wing. Does any of that make sense when you look at the Republican results yesterday?
Well, it, to me, says there is room for the Jim Douglas, Phil Scott Republican to win, Joe Benning being a key example here. Mm-hmm. But you have to run a campaign. You can't just simply assume that you're going to get support. If you are outworked, there is enough, you know, Trump support in this state that a more conservative Republican can eke out a victory, particularly in a low turnout primary here. You can't take anything for granted. And I think, again, it points to the factionalization of the Republican Party more generally. This is something the party is struggling with across the country, not just in Vermont. How much influence Trump's going to have?
Yeah. Let's look at the lieutenant governor's race. As expected, it seems, on the Democratic side, a pretty strong two-person race between David Zuckerman and Kitty Toll. Anything you take from that election?
Well, Toll ran a surprisingly strong race.
Yeah.
Let's be clear, Zuckerman won, but with only 44% of the vote here. I think there was some reluctance among some Democrats to have a progressive in that position, but they weren't able to coalesce behind an alternative. But it does show there are second acts in politics.
Yeah, there are. And I think David really needed a win after his gubernatorial run 2 years ago. He'll face Joe Benning, and as we mentioned, one of those standard bearers from the really moderate wing of the Republican Party, but was pushed pretty well by Gregory Thayer of Rutland.
Yeah, and I think in the end, 10-point victory, comfortable. But Thayer got 45% of the vote. So as we've talked about before, I mean, he was an unabashed Trump supporter, somebody who had participated in the January 6th riot, although he would probably argue not the riot part of it.
Right.
And the fact that he's able to get 45% of the vote, again, gets to the point we made earlier. There is strong support for the Trump wing of the Republican Party in this state.
Yeah. Secretary of State, very close race. It wound up being between Sarah Copeland-Hanzus and Chris Winters on the Democratic side. Has anyone been declared a winner yet, or is that still being counted?
So that I'm not sure. It is somewhat surprising. I thought Winters is sort of kind of hand-picked successor here was right. going to eke this one out. But she has a lot of name recognition from her work in the legislature, and that may have been enough to put her over the top.
Now, this is the race that multi-race GOP candidate H. Brooke Page says he'll compete in. Now, I do want to point this out, Matt Dickinson. I don't know if you ran the numbers yet, but the two top vote-getters in the state yesterday were, number one, Peter Welch, in his primary, where he had two other opponents, had about 86,000 votes. But number two was indeed H. Brooke Page, who, when you total it up, came close to Welch's numbers. I know we kind of laugh because H. Brooke Page runs a lot and fills in Republican positions where no one else has run, and then will step out if someone else would like to, you know, fill those positions in the general election. But he has said this is the one that he will campaign for in the general election. Any chance for Brooke Page this time around?
Well, there's always a chance. I think it's an uphill battle, and yeah. I wouldn't bet the house on it. You know, we do laugh, but he's strategic here. He realizes that by running in all these races, he then has 10 days to choose, but it opens up the possibility that the Republican caucus can select somebody else. It's better than just having an uncontested race.
Right.
In this way, the Republicans get a chance to run a candidate in the general election. So kudos to him. But it also is a reminder of just how weak the Republican bench is.
Yeah, it really is. Now, for Attorney General, this was another one I found a bit surprising. On the Democratic side, a bit of a walkover for Charity Clark over Rory Tebow, who I thought had a little more exposure in his position as Washington County State's attorney. Charity Clark, I believe, worked in the Attorney General's office, you know, not someone who gets a lot of face time. And policy-wise, I think there wasn't a ton of space between them. So do you have any insight that would show why Charity Clark won by such a big margin yesterday?
I do not. I thought this was a toss-up race.
Yeah.
I didn't see a huge difference in their policy stances. And it just really is, to me, somewhat of a surprise that, as you said, she won with 67% of the vote here. That's not even a close margin.
No. And the numbers were, you know, kind of out of the gate. I think for most of the night it was like 70-30, and then Tebow, you know, whittled a little bit back, got to about 33%. But I found that one to be pretty shocking, and good on Charity Clark. But again, there's a lot of that kind of face-to-face campaigning that we don't always know about, right?
Exactly.
You talk about a candidate outworking, and that might just be what was the difference.
I mean, she won statewide. It wasn't as if she racked up support in the high population area. She just was winning in rural areas, suburban areas, and high population areas.
Yeah. Now, let's just go to the more local elections. I did enjoy following the Wyndham Senate seat. It's being vacated by Jeanette White and Becca Ballant. Nader Hashim, who in the past has served in the State House, won the Democratic nomination. But on the GOP side, this was my favorite to watch all night long, three candidates. And basically, they all wound up with just about one-third of the vote. It was split so evenly. I don't know if there were any that you were following in a House or Senate race that you kind of were captivated by.
So what struck me was the number of uncontested races.
Yeah.
There's just, you go down the map here, and there's just a lot of uncontested races in the primaries. I didn't really have time to invest, last night I was scrambling to just keep up with everything else. So there wasn't one that particularly stood out for me. But one thing we do know, there's going to be new leadership in certainly in the Senate, with Molly Gray gone, with Becca Ballant gone, and a lot of the House committees, the chairs decided not to run for re-election. So there's going to be a lot of new blood coming into the General Assembly.
Oh, that's a great point. And looking to November, Matt, I know the lieutenant governor race is one that, you know, we'd probably say will be tight, but any others that you're really looking at with keen interest?
Well, the lieutenant governor's is the one that the Republicans probably have the best shot at.
Mm-hmm.
This is, again, it's just a reminder why yesterday's results were so important. In a state that is increasingly trending blue, and let's give kudos to Bernie Sanders and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. They were the big winners.
Yeah.
But it just it looks like an uphill climb in most of these statewide and federal offices for the Republican Party come November.
Yeah, it absolutely does.
Other than Phil Scott, of course.
Right.
Who, of course, is the odds-on favorite here to retain the governorship.
Yeah, and we'll be in 2 years wondering if he'll run for a fifth term, I'm guessing. Matt Dickinson is political science professor at Middlebury College. Matt, always great to get your perspective on the election results. Thanks for staying up so late last night.
My pleasure, Rick.
All right. We're going to take a break for CBS News to get an update, and then we're going to hear about this weekend's antique and classic car meet. And the Sox finish up their wee little two-game series against the Braves at Fenway tonight. Our coverage commences at 6:10, first heave 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Singeri. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at wdevradio.com.
We're back on Vermont Viewpoint. 48 hours from now, Farce Field in Waterbury will be filling up with dreams of eras gone by. Fancy fins, muscle cars, tricked out trucks, and cars built by companies some of you have never heard of and some who wish they were still made. This is Queen, I'm in Love with My Car. The Vermont automobile enthusiasts have shifted into high gear as they get ready for this weekend's Vermont Antique and Classic Car Meet taking place at Farce Field in Waterbury, Friday through Sunday. Joining me with all the details is Chris Barbieri of the Vermont Automobile Enthusiasts. Chris, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Great to be here, Rick. A great intro, by the way.
I thought you'd enjoy a little car music. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Chris about what's happening this weekend or maybe share what car you wish you still owned, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. A lot of people walk around and see that car that they once owned there on the field, the Farce Field, and really get kind of excited. Let's talk, Chris, first about the Vermont Automobile Enthusiasts. Who is this group?
It's a club that's for anyone who's interested in cars or just, you know, has an antique car or vehicle or just, you know, is looking at the idea of having one or just wants to stay up to speed on old cars. It's Vermont Automobile Enthusiasts, and we've been around since 1953.
Wow.
And the membership, we've got about 350 members, but 99% of them have a vehicle of some sort or another, an antique of some sort or another. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to have a car. If you collect maps, highway maps, maybe, you know, that's something. If you have an interest, any interest really that's involved in the hobby, we'd love to have you be a member. It's $35 a year. The club has a meeting every month, and we do cruises, of course, and in the months when it's possible to do it.
Mm-hmm.
In wintertime, we might have a meeting at somebody's antique car restoration facility or body shop or whatever. So it's a fun hobby. It's a fun club. We all get along together great. One of the things that's interesting about this show, as huge as it is, and you and I talked about this a while back, is that it's put on by all volunteers.
Yeah.
We don't pay anybody. And there's 10, 12 guys out there in the field right now today putting up the rows and putting the stakes in and all the signs up and doing everything that needs to be done. So that's one of the, I think, kind of neat things about this club is we do everything voluntarily.
How long has this car meet been going on?
Car meet has been going on since 1957, so it's 65 years this year. 2 years ago we had a skip, obviously, but we still counted a number of years. So, yeah, right. This is the 65th annual.
Wow. And for years held in Stowe, and then you shifted here to Forest Field in Waterbury.
Mm-hmm. That wasn't intentional, although Waterbury had been asking us, you know, if we would like to move any time, just let them know. But we lost the field in Stowe. It was sold, and we really in no way could have afforded to what the new owner wanted. So we moved here to Far Field, and be honest with you, it's a great move for us.
Yeah,
it's a flat field, whereas it was pretty hilly in Stowe. It drains really well if you have any rain. And it being flat, we were able more to put the cars in one area and the flea market in another and so on. So it's a little bit easier to navigate.
And right off exit 10, the Waterbury exit, you hit the roundabout and then take 2 west, and it's just a few miles up the road. When you come into it over the weekend, you're easily led onto the field. Great parking. It's funny, a couple things got me excited about this meet again. 2 weeks, I'm thinking, it's not this weekend, but I come off the exit. I come down from Colchester to Waterbury every day, and behind me is a beautiful old kind of light blue Mustang ragtop with the top down, and I'm thinking, are they coming in already for the car show? And then on Saturday, I was down the southern part of the state, heading up 7A between Bennington and Arlington, and there's an old gas station, a gas station with the oldest Shell pumps I've ever seen. It's not like really fixed up, and they're sitting out front, and I thought, this is what gets people excited for this car meet, right?
Yeah.
That nostalgia of what was.
And I mean, part of this is the calendar. I mean, we only have about 7 months of the year in Vermont to enjoy your cars and do all of the things that you could do in other states.
Right.
But the hobby is – it's a passion. It really is. And it's an opportunity for folks who have old cars or antique cars to get out and enjoy them and drive them and go to a show and show them off a little bit, so to speak. But – if you go to the show and you wander around and you're just looking at the cars and listening to the conversations that go on,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, wow, you know, I remember this was my grandmother's car.
Right.
You can listen to two antique car owners. One may have, you know, a 1953 Plymouth, and the other one may have a 1937 or a 1927 Pierce Arrow. And they're talking cars. I mean, it's not like, well, this is my car and that's your car. It's like, this is our cars. And it's a hobby that is shared by a lot of people who haven't, you know, we may not think have an antique car or an old car. They do have one. And it's maybe it doesn't get out of the garage very often, but it's just a fun hobby. It really is.
Well, for the spectators, when you're walking around and, I don't know, all of a sudden you find yourself in front of an old Hudson Hornet, mm-hmm. You know, or a Hutmobile or whatever it might be, and you're oohing and aahing, you're just stunned by the design of this automobile. And then there's the owner. First of all, you can just see the pride welling up, and they come out and talk to you. I might not know a thing about this automobile, except I'm just – taking in the beauty of it, and then they tell you the story of it.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about our show is that it gets a lot of cars, what you call pre-World War II vehicles,
mm-hmm.
which you don't see much anymore. And most of the car shows, they may have a few, but most of the car shows are, you know, post-war, from 50s, 60s, 70s, and now even 80s. But our show gets a lot of the pre-war cars, you know, the real classics. But if you look at the workmanship and the craftsmanship of some of these cars, the Pierce Arrows, the Hutmobiles, some of the Imperials and the Packards and Cadillacs, unbelievable craftsmanship. beautiful vehicles.
Where do these people who are presenting or showing their cars, where are they coming from this weekend to be here?
Well, show cars are going to be mostly, you know, from New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, upstate New York.
Mm-hmm.
Although we get them from Connecticut, Maine, we get them from Pennsylvania, yeah. Show cars we're talking about now. It was more than that. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago, there was a guy who brought a car up from South Carolina for the show.
And that's, oh, my gosh.
That's a distance award winner for sure.
Will we see people coming down from Canada again? I know that kind of stopped
yes.
for the last few years.
Canada, the Canadian car collectors, we've had a lot of them over the years in Stowe. And when we moved to Waterbury, that was trickled down a little bit. We weren't quite as many. But since then, the number of Canadian spectators as well as cars are increasing again.
Good.
And this year, with the opening of the border and when I market the show, I put a lot more emphasis this year into Montreal and Eastern Townships.
Yeah.
So I think that we're going to have a good number of cars. In fact, I know one person in the show who lives in Canada, who's a member of our club, said that he was bringing down 7 other of his friends up there who have antique cars. So right there, we're going to have a group.
Oh, that's
but I
so
think we're
exciting.
Going to have quite a few more, both cars from Canada as well as spectators.
The other thing that really impresses me is how affordable this is. So tell people about ticket prices.
Yeah, it's $15 for spectators. It's $15 yeah. per adult, 12 years or younger, is free.
Yeah.
And the ticket is good for the full day. And, you know, we've got all kinds of stuff going on. We've got the Car Corral, which is where people who want to sell antique cars can put their cars for the 3 days for $50. We have a huge automotive flea market. We got the show cars, of course. We have a parade in downtown Waterbury on Saturday. And we got the street dance right here.
Yes,
Joel
indeed.
Najman will be doing his thing again.
Yep.
So there's a lot of activities going on. We have a crafter's tent, which is something that we put in place about 10 years ago now. So if you're dragged to the show by, you know, your husband or your wife or your friend or whatever, and
yeah.
you really aren't interested, go to the crafter's tent where you can buy and see all kinds of craft Vermont crafts.
And a lot of great food on offer.
A lot of great food all the time. How could I miss that?
Let's head to Barry and talk to Bill. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Bill.
Hey. I want to bring you back a few years. When I was in college, I don't have it now. I'm older than it. But in 1952, for 125, I was in college.
Yep.
For $125, I bought a 39 Packard coupe.
Oh.
And it was green, so everybody in the campus knew this car and me. And we called it the Green Ghost. And I hate to tell you the things we did with it, but when you put the brakes on, it would shake, you know, how without the shocks. And we could ride on the running boards, and when you went to a drive-in, people would sit on the fenders and all kinds
yeah.
of things. You could stack a lot of people in it. And, well, you know, it was just everybody on the campus knew it. And
how
it
long
was,
did you own it, Bill?
3 years. It lasted me 3 years.
You got your buck and a quarter out of it.
That car today, in good condition, would go for a whole lot more than $125.
It sure would.
Let me tell you something. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can.
Okay. I went to Vanderbilt in Nashville and lived in Sarasota, Florida. So once a friend of mine, Freddie Boylan, we drove down to Sarasota and back in it. And when we were approaching Nashville, it was nighttime, and the headlights went out, and luckily we had flashlights, and that's how we got back home.
That's a great story. Thanks, Bill. Hey, let's move on to Berlin. Talk to Steve. What do you got for us, Steve?
Yes, well, I was calling in because my uncle had a 1928 Chrysler Imperial, and we had to take about 3 cans of wax just to shine it up for the show.
Oh, nice.
And that was when it was up on the mountain.
Oh,
yeah, that's right.
Show my age.
That's a beautiful car. Those Chrysler Imperials back then were just beautiful handcraft cars.
Oh, it was. That was the rumble seat and all.
Oh, is it still around, Steve, the car?
And then he passed away, so my aunt wasn't interested. So she did sell it to somebody from Canada.
Yeah. Interesting. Oh, it's beautiful. Thanks for that, Steve. We should mention times, dates for the show, and then you want to talk about parking as well at Forest Field.
Yes. The show begins on Friday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Friday, a lot of the cars are coming in.
Yeah.
We're open from – officially open from 8 o'clock in the morning until 6, although usually a little early and a little bit later. It still works. So that's on Friday, and the Car Corral is open, of course, in the flea market. On Saturday, that's the biggest day because it's a weekend, and we get a lot of folks there. That's about the time when you're going to see the most cars on the field is on Saturday.
Yeah.
The same thing goes for the flea market. And we have the street dance on right here, sponsored by WDEV.
On Stowe Street here.
Starting at 7 o'clock, 7 until 10. And we also have the parade through Waterbury Village, and that starts at about 3:30. So there's a lot happening those 2 days. And then Sunday, the cars are still on the field, of course. And that's when cars that wish to be judged, or vehicles that wish to be judged,
right,
are judged. And the judges work from about 9:30 in the morning until noon. And then those decisions are made one, two, and three, three classes. And the awards then will be presented at around 1:30 or 2 o'clock.
So times, is it 8 to 6 Friday, 8 to 6 Saturday, and
yeah,
then
and then
on
8
Sunday
to 4 officially on Sunday, although by 2:30 or so, it's pretty much shut down.
And there's free parking right at Forest Field.
Free parking at Forest Field. We have a new road for a quicker exit if you head out. I should mention, by the way, that between Richmond and Bolton, the road is torn up on Route 2, about Route 2 now. And it's a lot of construction, a lot of paving, a lot of digging, a lot of dust.
Yeah.
So if you're coming that way from the Burlington area, I'd suggest get on the interstate.
Yes.
And avoid Route 2, and then get off at exit 10, and you know how to get there from here.
Yeah. So that's a great point. It's always quicker, even when there isn't that construction onto west of where we'll be, Forest Field. Take the interstate down to exit 10 at Waterbury. When you hit the roundabout, you're going to take basically the first turn onto 2 West, and it'll just be ahead a few miles,
And
that's the much quicker way to go. We've got a couple pair of tickets we want to give away to the Vermont Automobile Classic Car an antique and classic car meet this Friday through Sunday. So first couple callers in right now at 802-244-1777, 877-291-TALK or 877-291-8255. First couple, we'll get a pair of tickets, and we'll have them here at the station for you to pick up. Speaking with Chris Barbieri of the Vermont Automobile Enthusiast, we've talked a lot about what's going to happen. What is your favorite part of this event? I know you get so jazzed about it. You're probably the busiest person around the state right now. But what is it that gets you so excited?
Well, for me, when I have time, is the flea market.
Yeah.
I love walking around the flea market because what you find there are things that you may never know existed. Or if you're looking for something, you'll find it. It's not open to anything except antique car stuff.
Right.
You know, don't bring a jam, don't bring dishes, don't bring anything like that. It's all car stuff. And I enjoy walking around and talking to the vendors and, you know, trying to see how it went for them during the show.
Yeah.
And of course the cars, you know, just walking through, it's like a history lesson in automobilia, you know.
Yeah.
It's just cars from 1905, 1910 all the way up through 1997, which, of course, is still an antique.
Yeah, I get kind of jazzed in that flea market. You might see a neat old hood ornament from a Packard, or it might be a sign from a Buick Riata, which was one of my early cars that I loved.
Those were nice cars.
Weren't they nice?
They were nice.
Oh, great little two-seater. But, you know, you walk around, and there might be models of,
toy cars.
Right?
Yeah. And highway maps. You know, antique highway maps are big. That's another one. So anything that's related to the hobby certainly is there as well in the flea market.
Yeah.
And then there's a crafter's tent, as I mentioned earlier, which a lot of folks also enjoy walking through and having a good time.
What's your sweet spot when it comes to these antique and classic cars? What do you really, you have a few, I think, but
the ones I like, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my dream car has always been a 1957 Corvette. I'll never have one. I can never afford one. But
right.
But I'm a Chrysler products guy. I'm a Chrysler products guy, and you know, early mid '60s are my favorite era.
Yeah, we do have our winners, so if you're calling, thanks so much, and we gave a couple pairs away, but you can pick up tickets right at Farr's Field as you head to the event this weekend, going on Friday through Sunday.
Pick them up here, actually.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The tickets, the winners will pick them up here at WDEV. But if you didn't win, you know, going to the show, you can buy them as you drive in Friday through Sunday. And starting at 8 each morning, going to 6 on Friday, 6 on Saturday, and then 4 o'clock on Sunday. And who can show up for the street party here on Saturday night? Joel Nashman.
Joel is going to be here. Yeah, yeah. We're going to try to identify cars, antique cars, to line Stowe Street, and some probably around the corner, also on Main Street.
Yeah.
So that'll be there. So that'll kind of set the whole theme for the evening. And of course, you know, everything from, we know Joel.
Yeah.
It'll be, and I'm sure he'll be taking requests as well.
Absolutely. I'll probably throw on the poodle skirt, but that, you know, it's not necessary.
I can't wait.
But he plays great period music from those times. All right. What else do we need to talk about to let people know about what's going on this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday?
I think it's important for us to let people know that if we make money at these shows, and that doesn't always happen, but if we make money at the show, that goes to scholarships that we provide for kids who are going to the auto tech program at Vermont Technical College.
Yeah.
Or, you know, for high school students who are moving on to the next level, we will support them with scholarships and other ways to succeed.
That's outstanding.
Yeah.
And I know a lot is weather dependent. So what weather have you arranged for this weekend?
You know, I've always said, if you want to end a drought, have a car show.
Yeah.
But this year, it's going to be this, I think, reaching back over the years, that
last
this
year
is going to be the best
too.
We ever had.
Yeah.
The weather forecast is perfect.
All right.
In the 70s, no rain, blue skies, you know, it's perfect.
You heard it from Chris Barbieri. He promises the best weather ever this weekend. Chris Barbieri of the Vermont Automobile Enthusiasts, one of the busiest, most excited people in the state this week, because the Vermont Antique and Classic Car Meet is starting Friday, runs through Sunday at Farr's Field in Waterbury. You can learn more at vtauto.org. Chris, I want to thank you for being on the show, and I'll see you on Friday morning.
Absolutely. Thanks. Thank you, Rick.
All right. We're going to take a break, go ahead to CBS News, and then we'll be back to learn about what's happening at the Noise House Museum in Mooresville. And coming up at 11 this morning, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. We spent the last half hour getting excited about historic vehicles. Now let's go deeper into local history with a stop at the Noise House Museum in Mooresville. Joining me now to let us know what's happening there is Tracy Harther. She is the director of the Noise House Museum. Tracy, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you back. Listeners, to ask Tracy about the museum or about Mooresville history, you can call us at 802-244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You got a lot of exhibitions going on, a lot of events. But before we get there, I just want a little bit of history of the Noise House itself.
Okay, that's easy. Well, the Noise House itself was, kind of a complicated story, but...
Not that easy, then.
It's not that hard.
Okay.
So the brick portion of the house, if you've ever seen it, was built between 1820 and 1830 by the Safford family. They own the mill that's now on Feline Street. And they were they owned a sawmill and a grist mill. Later, the house was sold, and it went through a few owners until Carlos Noyes purchased the house in 1875. And he added a large L that attached to the barn, and they lived there until they passed away. His son, Arthur, remained in the home until the early 50s. And then when he passed away, the house was donated to the town because he didn't have any heirs to leave the home to. So at the same time, the Historical Society was forming at the library, and they were running out of room with all their stuff. So they joined with the town, and we took over the Noyes House Museum, or the Noyes House, and then turned it into the Noyes House Museum, which is basically run by the Morristown Historical Society. So we house all the collections at the museum.
All right.
And put on exhibits and programming. It's really a great place.
Well, let's start with one of the exhibits you have going on right now. Tell us about the 19th and 20th century medicine exhibit that's going on at the Noyes House.
Well, in one of our exhibit rooms, we have a collection of 19th and 20th century medicine, medical supplies, you know, everything from an amputation saw to giant needles that are pretty scary to look at today. we have medicine bottles and reading material, and we are featuring also the Copley Hospital. We have a photo of the first hospital, which is now across the street from the Copley Hospital we know today, which was the Wheelock House, which Alexander Copley purchased in the 30s and turned it into the first hospital in Morrisville.
Wow. All right. I might stay out of there, though. You know, I'm not going to spend a ton of time in that room. You got me a little scared with the amputation.
It's not that bad.
All right. No worries. What are some things that, you know, are in your permanent collection there at the Noyes House that people come and love to see?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many things.
I know.
When we give tours of the museum, we have all these wonderful objects, but the thing we really strive for is when people come in to visit is to tell the stories of the objects. One of my favorite things in our formal parlor, which is a standing exhibit, is a table that was made for the Fisk family. And inside, on the inset of the table, are all 50 states with their capitals, which was hand calligraphied for an 18-year-old by an 18-year-old for the Fisk family when they got married. Now, the Fisks were traveling ministers. They traveled all over the country and went to different churches and ministered there. So this table traveled with them as they traveled across the United States, and it's really just a wonderful, wonderful object and a cool story to go with it.
Yeah, that's an outstanding piece. All right. Now, I really love this next exhibit. It's of the Randall Hotel. So give us a little history of the Randall Hotel.
Well, the Randall Hotel was built in 1891 in downtown Morrisville. It's where the gas station and the Walgreens is today, across the street from the Cumberland Farms.
Oh, yeah.
So it was built as this grand hotel in 1891 by the Randall family. And it housed all the people that came to visit Morrisville because Morrisville was on the train tracks. You know, the train came through Morrisville, and
sure,
the hotel was right down the road. And it stayed open till the 50s. In the interim, it had a roof fire in 1927, and the whole roof burned down. They rebuilt it. They fixed it up. And then in 1950s, they tore it down, and, you know, now we have a Walgreens and a gas station.
Mm. What kind of items will we find in that exhibit?
Well, the items we have a number of images of the Randall Hotel, both before and after the fire. We have the doors from the hotel, the original sign, We have a great picture of the interior of the hotel, including the barbershop, and then we have some of the barbershop supplies, shaving mug, straight razors, stuff like that. We have the coffee grinder that they use, and then we also have various pamphlets advertising the Randall Hotel, including some of their menus from when they serve dinners.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and Tracy, would these be items that are part of the museum, the Historical Society's collection, or are these things that maybe local people have kept and have lent to the museum for this exhibit?
Nope, these are all things that were donated from the community to us and that we keep and use when we decide to do certain exhibits. We really have an amazing collection, and it's due to the generosity of the people in Morristown.
Yeah. When can people come to the Noyes House Museum? When are you open?
We are open on Thursdays from 12 to 4 and Friday and Saturdays from 10 to 4.
And then how long do you stay open through the year?
We close – that's kind of a trick question. We close at the end of October because we don't have heat.
Right.
So by the end of October, we close for the season, and then we open back up Memorial Day weekend.
Okay. Yeah. I thought there was, a certain limited schedule as we get towards the end of the year. But right now, open Thursdays, 9 to 4 – I'm sorry, noon to 4.
12 to 4.
Yeah,
yes.
Noon to 4, and then Friday and Saturday, 10 to 4. All right, one more that you've got going on is the uniforms, medals, and honors. So tell us about that exhibit.
That exhibit is a exhibit for a military exhibit, and mm-hmm. we have on display Civil War jackets, World War II jackets from the Army, the Navy, and the Marines. We have a Korean jacket as well. And then we have just a number of medals that were donated to us from various military families throughout the community. We have my favorite. We have a Bronze Star, Distinguished Service Cross, and a Purple Heart from a gentleman who grew up in Morrisville, who unfortunately did not return from World War II, but saved a number of lives in his service there, including we also have from this gentleman the letter that was sent to his family from Truman telling them that he had passed away and thanking them for their family service.
In town, there's I think it's right where like 15A and 12 kind of split. There's a wonderful historical monument. I think it might be for those who served in the Civil War. Am I right about that?
You are correct.
Oh, okay. Well done. I know, and you're probably getting such great response to this, the military memorabilia from anybody who's into military history. I have a brother who would probably spend hours in that room just to soak up what you have there.
Yeah, it really is a great display. And there is just quite a number of people in Morrisville that served in the military from the War of 1812 all the way through to Vietnam.
Mm. Tracy, I think we have one more, and this is for those who love to read, the Literacy and Literature in Victorian America exhibit. Tell us about what people will see in that exhibit.
In that exhibit, what we're talking about is in the early 1900s, there were literacy among women especially became more prevalent. And it was the Victorian time. And at that time, a lot of the literacy in the women's magazine, for example, the Women's Home Companion became a popular magazine for women to have. But at the same time, what a lot of this literature did was reinstill these Victorian values, which were very different than they are today, everything from how they should do their hair or what they should wear to how they should behave in public, from, having to wear a hat when they went outside or having to wear gloves, especially if you were going to touch a male, you know, shake someone's hand or something like that, you would have to have gloves on. So really what we're focusing on is how the literacy of the day, including stories, they would have soap opera-like stories in some of the magazines, they were consistently pushing these values back on women. So that's what the expectation was.
Incredible.
And so throughout that exhibit, we have the clothes that the women would wear, the corsets, the gloves, the hats, the shoes, the parasols. Because if you had a tan, that meant you worked, and that was frowned upon.
We did have a caller who couldn't stay on the line, but they wondered if the Historical Society and the museum still accept historical items from the area as a donation.
We absolutely do. We have to be very choosy about what we take because we have limited exhibit space and limited storage, but that doesn't mean we won't accept things. But one of the things that we really strive in our collections is having a story connected to Morristown or Morrisville, because that's really what make these objects come alive.
Great. Is there a number they can call to find out if you'd be interested?
Yes, absolutely. They can call the museum number, which is 888-7617, or they can email us at noisehousemuseum@gmail.com. Perfect. Either way, we'll get back to them.
All right. Let's get into – you have a good list of events coming up, too. First of all, Bill Schubart will be coming for a reading.
Yes. We have been collaborating with the Morristown Centennial Library for a few events, and that is one of them. So they do – at the library, they do what's called a group read, where they have one book available – for the community, and their book that they chose is called Lila and Theron. It was written by Bill Schubart. So we are going to have an event at the library, kind of like a book club.
Mm-hmm.
But we, the museum, are going to bring objects and items that connect to the book, as well as have Bill Schubart come and visit and talk about his book and the process of writing it, and maybe do some readings of the book as well.
So Bill will be there at the library, right, Wednesday, mm-hmm. September 14th at 6 o'clock. And then just about a week later, you're going to feature someone who has children named Lila and Theron.
You are correct. Bill Mudgett is going to be, again, this is at the library, on September 20th at 6 p.m., Jill is going to do a program about the historic architectural style of the Morrisville Village, which should be really fascinating because there's some really cool elements about some of the buildings, like the false third story, stuff like that.
All right. That's fabulous. That really interests me. And that is September 20th at 6 o'clock. And you said that will be at the library where Dr. Jill Mudgett will be speaking?
Yes, the three talks are at the library because, I mean, the Historical Society started at the library, so it really makes sense for us to collaborate with them, and they're such a great group of people.
Okay, and there you said three, so tell us about the third one then.
The third one, hold on, let me get my stuff, is on October 22nd. It's at 11 a.m., and it is Dr. Louis Fivanco from UVM, and he is doing a talk of Wheelman, The New Women and Good Roads, Bicycling in Vermont from 1880 to 1920. And this event, we are encouraging visitors to bike to the event.
All right. That's on October 22nd at 11. And then I skipped right over the one that's coming up the soonest is a mixer. So tell us all about what's going on there.
Well, currently we are doing our membership drive. And so we have letters out to our current members, but we also want to let the community know that they can either come into the museum and get a membership form, or they can go online to our website, which is noisehousemuseum.org. And we also have a donations page where you can pay by PayPal just because it's easier sometimes. And our members are invited on August 25th at 6 p.m. to a wine and cheese mixer as a thank you for supporting the museum.
All right. And that is, again, August 25th at 6 p.m. And if you go to noisehousemuseum.org, you can get a membership. Why support the Noise House Museum? Why become a member, Tracy?
Well, membership is really important to us because it helps offset the cost of exhibits, programming, because most of our – we don't charge to come to the museum. We – if there's a – if you want to leave a donation, you can, but we try – we decided this year to make the museum free to all visitors just because we feel it's the right thing to do. So it offsets also our operational costs as well.
Well, that is so great. And having a resource like this in town is just another way to make the community so cohesive. But tell me about one more piece. We've got about a minute left. I think you have a Native American canoe that you love so much there.
We do. We have a dugout canoe. We are not sure if it is an Abenaki dugout or possibly – it could be what the colonists called a logboat, which is basically the exact same thing, just a different name.
Mm-hmm.
But these dugouts and logboats were a great early form of transportation. They don't require deep water. And in the early days, it was the easiest way to travel was by the river.
Yeah.
And so we have that displayed in our... in our barn, and we have an image of Ron Stancliffe, who found the logboat or dugout, as it was, in Joe's Pond up on Stancliffe Road.
I love it. The Noise House Museum is open Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Tracy Harther is the director of the Noise House Museum in Morrisville, and you can learn more about the exhibits and the events at the museum and becoming a member at noisehousemuseum.org. Tracy, great having you back on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having us.
You're welcome. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here tomorrow when we talk about EVs, Pepper Mills, and Shakespeare. And we'll also talk with national correspondent Bob Ney.